This week on Art on the Air, a returning interview with the University of Nevada at Reno Professor of Linguistics, Dr. Valerie Friedland, a sociolinguist discussing her new book, Why We Talk Funny, the real story behind our accents and how they define each one of us. Our spotlight's at Chicago Street Theater's Teen Fest, May 22nd and 23rd, with program director Lisa Formoso Perugino.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And Art on the Air encourages our loyal listeners to support this station by making a monthly sustaining pledge, so we may continue to bring you this great program.
We are happy to welcome back Valerie Friedland to Art on the Air. Valerie was a guest on November 19th of 2023 discussing her book, Like Literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good and Bad English. She's a professor of linguistics at the University of Nevada, Reno in the Department of English. Her most recent book is Why We Talk Funny, The Real Story Behind Our Accents. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Valerie. It's very wonderful seeing you again.
Yes, yeah, such a delight to be back. Thank you for having me.
Well, and as we talked about just before we started, I kind of love linguistics and especially concentrated on the history of English. I always find that fascinating and how our Germanic tongue became entwisted all the way to what we got now, and especially how American English is all that. And that's kind of what your new book is about. If people want to find out more about her, you can listen to her interview, I usually say your origin story, because her origin story is on the recording that we did in a previous interview, and you can link to that. So, but we want to tell you what prompted you to book after you did your previous book, which like Literally Dude, I sensed from some of the writing that you maybe got feedback from students or colleagues as kind of what's the next step. So tell us about what prompted you to do this.
Sure. Well, you know, Like Literally Dude was really born out of my experiences with both students and then people at sort of the popular lectures that I tend to give out in the world on language, because I would talk about accents, which is really what I've studied for my whole career. That's what I started with. That's what my dissertation was on. And that's what all my academic work is on, is American accents, specifically American regional accents and accents of class and gender and those kinds of things. But when I was going to talks and I'd give talks about accents, people would be interested because people are interested in accents. But a lot of times also in the questions, people would say, hey, what about like? Why do people say like so much? And, you know, I really hate, a lot of times people would start with, I really hate it when, you know, X. And a lot of times that was people say literally too much. People say too much. People say like too much. And so that really is what drove my last book. It was all the comments that people had about what they feel about language, because there's actually a really fascinating history behind those features and also a purpose to them, or we wouldn't do them. So I felt like I should really write the book to clear the air for all these features people love to hate, because they're really so much more valuable than we give them credit for. But the accent part was something that has been really dear to me my whole life. My parents were accented speakers from another country, so they had, we all have accents, but they had foreign accents. And I grew up in the South, which also has its own accent stuff going on. So it was kind of like indoctrinated into me as a 2-year-old, as a 5-year-old, that accents were salient and important and part of who we are. And I felt very much like they were part of my identity in many ways, both as the child of parents who people were always asking where they were from and found their accents fascinating. But also when I left the South, I never had a strong Southern accent, but I had certainly things that were more salient about being a Southerner in my speech at that point. When I left to go to college and graduate school, just the commentary people would have about the way I talked or my friends talked, I really was interested in why it's such a big part of our social identity, not only in how we think of ourselves, but really strongly in terms of how other people think about us. And that's what led me to become a linguist. So this is really who I am, this book, I think, in many more ways than the other book was, in the sense that I study this so much, I live this so much, that this seemed like the natural book to write next. And it's a little hard to write about accents because they're so sound-based, but I think I've taught them so for so long that there are really cool ways around that to get people to remember what they've heard in the past and feel their own accents by having them do little fun accent things in the book, that I think I was able to avoid that. But it probably would have been a hard sell with the publisher with the first book out of the go. Let me write about sounds in a book. But I think they felt good that I could do it after that first book. So this is really kind of, I guess, the passion project book in some ways.
So Valerie, do you recall as a child ever having been told that your speech had a French lilt to it due to your parents? I mean, maybe you don't recall, but was that ever part of your history?
Oh, I do. And in fact, a story I tell in the book is how when I was, I think it was in kindergarten, I was wanting to do show and tell. You know how cool it is to do show and tell when you're a young kid. And I had this giant teddy bear that was like 3 feet tall. It was this big white teddy bear. And I was so impressed by it. It was the, you know, it was the prize acquisition of my early childhood. So I brought it to school. You know, I'm pulling it in the classroom under my arm. And I get up to talk about it, and I'm like, I got this huge teddy bear. And I said, huge, with as an unaspirated H. I said, the huge teddy bear, kind of very New Yorker of me, I guess. And it's because my parents didn't have H's. French doesn't aspirate its H. Common Latin, Vulgar Latin didn't aspirate H's, right? This is why Romance languages don't aspirate H's. And so I had picked that up without being aware of it. And it wasn't until my little kindergartner friends were all like, oh my God, you talk funny. Why did you say it that way? That I realized I said it differently than other people. And that's the truth about our accents. We don't hear our own accents. Everybody has one, but we don't hear them until someone else notices them, or we're in a place where our difference contrasts with the people that live there. And then all of a sudden we're like, wow, I do have an accent. And sort of that's what happened with me with the French underlying, you know, aspects of my accent as a child.
I know we talked about it before. I mean, kind of allude to that the standard Midwestern accent, which I know I do some voiceover work and you have to categorize your voice. And I think in the, like for voices, I have to say male, obviously, American English, Northern American, Chicago, Great Lakes. And the other one is American English, Northern Midland, because, you know, when people are looking for your voice and they can listen to a sample. So that, and that's been the broadcast standard. It's kind of like in BBC, they had the BBC English. So they've pulled away from that because they have a lot of other speakers. But like in broadcasting for many, many years, the Midwestern accent was the standard, even down south. I mean, most of the broadcasters down there. So, and yet I would say I don't consider myself having an accent. We have sort of an accent here where we live. It's called the region. And it's sort of influenced by Chicago. It's a little harder talking if you kind of do that, you know, it's everything. And then there's code switching. I don't know. You probably never knew Mayor Daley, the original Mayor Daley in Chicago, but he was a code switcher. He would talk fairly eloquently, but when he wanted to make a point and when he was getting like attacked by reporters, he switched to his Bridgeport accent, like, you know, where he got kind of tough, almost a gangster style. So
right,
code switching.
Project a personality, right? Yeah. We all do that. And some of us have more flexibility in the repertoire we have right. For that, but we all do it. What's funny is as you're talking about being accented, unaccented, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, what an inland north accent he has. So you have certain vowels that are affected by a process called the Northern City Shift, that's especially in the area that Chicago is in, but also the inland north and Great Lakes region. Now, it's not really prevalent among younger speakers from that area, but it's absolutely something that you have in your speech. So it's funny, you know, when you hear someone describe themselves as not having an accent, but you are from a different place, you're thinking, oh, you have an accent. But we just don't notice it in ourselves. And also people that get professional training, I've noticed that broadcasters are the hardest to tag from being a certain place because they really work on right. not having any distinctive features. That still doesn't mean you don't have an accent, but what we tend to do is eradicate the ones that are really salient from our speech when we work in professional contexts where speech is of a certain type that is expected. And I think that's probably what you've done as well.
Right. Well, and also when you get just a tiny bit tired, sometimes you can slip back into, yeah.
Because you're not doing as much monitoring of your speech, right?
And what's interesting in Indiana is how we really have kind of three distinct groups. Like there's, well, like in our corner, we have an even more distinct group because there's northern, and it's a very northern thing. You get south about, well, I would say now south of the Kankakee River, you start getting kind of more of a Midland accent. And then you get close to the Ohio River, and they're almost in Kentucky. I mean, it's there's right, three right. distinct, you know, we always knew that. Years ago, a long time ago, I used to work in the police department, and when we'd have gatherings of the other people from all over, you could tell almost where they were from if they were deep in South Indiana and everything. So it was very distinctive by identifying them. And then you talk about that in your book, how that really does identify where you're from kind of to people.
Absolutely. I think, you know, with the Midwestern states and places like Indiana and Ohio, something that's really salient to people that live there is the differences between the north part of that state and the south part of that state. There's often a lot of comments about how, you know, you can absolutely tell where someone's from because of that divide, if they're from the north or the south. And if you look back at the settlement patterns of those states early on, what you see is really a split in who was settling it and that fell along that line. And often rivers are the, you know, pinnacle of accent divisions because they were hard to cross. And so it kept people from chatting with each other. So you often find it follows either mountain ranges or rivers or things like that.
Or we have two time zones.
Yes, and time zones, exactly. So speech kind of falls on each of those sides. And you had a lot more Germanic and Northern British settlement on the north side of those states, and then a lot more Scots-Irish settlement on the south side of those states. And so that and Southern British. And so that kind of made this early input something we call founder's effects, which means the actual features don't stick around, but the significant cultural divides and linguistic divides, the fact that they're different, seem to stick around over years. And you can still see people talk about those distinctions. And actually in Nevada, it's very similar. People from the north of Nevada and people from the south always call out each other as doing things differently. And speech is also a little bit like that here too.
Well, even in your book, it was so interesting to read that people from Southern England actually first moved to the southern part of the United States. You know, I didn't really think that there was that distinction as they were coming over. So that was interesting to read in your book.
Well, it was, you know, that was sort of, if you were going to say, okay, I need to say what the majority background of those settlers right. that went to, in Jamestown were from, it was predominantly Southern British dialect inputs. But I think it's sort of a false idea to say that there wasn't a huge amount of diversity. And that was sort of the central tendency, but there were still a ton of people from other parts of Britain, from Wales, right, from Ireland, but also from other countries. You know, there were actually French Huguenots in that area as well, a little bit later, obviously not at the early settlement, but it certainly did seem to influence some of the patterns that we see over time. The fact that there were more Southern British speakers in those early settlements in that area, of course, in Pennsylvania and the Mid-Atlantic colonies, and that was really most influential on the heartland speech of Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, those states. That was actually primarily Quaker settlement of the British background, and most Quakers were from the northern part of England because that was really the heart of Quakerism. And they, as many of them had actually moved out of the country already and lived in, I think it was the Netherlands for a while before settling in Pennsylvania. So you had really diverse settler input at that time. So I think we have to say it was really a mix, but absolutely in New England and Jamestown, if you were going to say the central tendency of those speakers was definitely Southern British.
Right. And I know you talked about like probably the second, the way they passed down in families, like the second or third peer came to the United States, especially more in the South. And then they kind of, and of course, that's a little bit later on to establish property, because they weren't going to get any property because of the, what they call it, primature in England. And the eldest son gets the whole shooting match and everything. I know my own history, having done my ancestry, both sides of my family are Germanic, and they came here pre-revolution. I'm a son of the American Revolution, I found out. But anyway, and the Steinbrecher on my mother's side became a Stonebreaker, and Brechner, of course, is. And so they definitely.
Oh, I love it.
And you could follow their course into, well, Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania eventually to middle Indiana. And then the quick story is my grandfather, I guess he got in trouble with his father, and his, I guess he beat him or something. At 16, he clobbered him and moved up north to Northwest Indiana. Didn't know if he killed him or not. That's my family story. And so that's how he got to Northwest Indiana.
Wow, that's pretty juicy. It's like true crime now. We're turning a corner.
I guess he didn't kill him, because my dad said when he was a little boy, he did go see his grandfather. But yeah, it was kind of an interesting family story. But it's kind of interesting to follow that ancestry trail and how it affects your language and everything. So, well, I know you talk about one thing, which I think is called word aversion. And I found that was so funny. And I don't know if I have the same reaction to the key word that you picked, moist, and because it sounds, but tell us about word aversion and in that case, moist, and how that sometimes do that, the history of that and how that became to be.
I just want to warn you, 20% of your listeners have just shut this off now because they can't take hearing that word. You know, it's funny because the book's about accents, but there are actually a lot of really fascinating things that we wonder about with sound itself that I felt like needed a place in this book, even though they weren't necessarily accents in the way we tend to think of it. So moist is a word, it's not an accent, and the sounds are obviously the word, the things that make up that word. I also have a chapter on what makes a language sound beautiful. So same thing, not really directly accent, but they're just so fascinating and such a big part of the way we react to the people around us that I couldn't help but put it in. And the story of the chapter on moist was that I have a really good friend who's Australian, actually. And one night we were having dinner, and I think it was, you know, chicken. I don't even remember what we were having, but I said something about, wow, this is super moist. And she started screaming. I'm like, stop it. Stop it. I hate that word. And so, of course, anytime I ever ate with her afterwards, I had to use that word around her because I'm just that kind of friend. But so I thought, why, you know, I said, why do you hate that word? And she's like, I just can't stand the way it sounds. So I started doing a little research on, you know, how many people hate moist, because it had never been a word I loved. I'm not going to name a child moist or anything. But I didn't have that kind of visceral hatred of it that she clearly had. And so I started asking other friends, and half of them were like, I hate moist. If you say that around me, we can't be friends.
So where are they originally from, though? Because I think it's more of a southern word almost. No,
none of these people were from the South. And actually,
no, I mean, that's why they don't like it, because I think we in the South we use moist.
Oh, maybe
more often,
possibly. Yeah. But I think honestly, when I looked at the research, regional background had nothing to do with the findings,
the aversion
on
to it.
Aversion. So it may be that it's more frequently heard there, but that just means we're irritating more people more often. But the backstory on moist is that there's a lot going on with it in terms of what it's associated with. So it came into English from Old French during the Middle English period. And it was really used to describe things that were fresh as opposed to stale, you know, so like fresh vegetables or fresh beer. In fact, Chaucer uses it to describe moist and corny ale in the Canterbury Tales. And corny at that time meant hoppy or weedy. That's what corny meant there. And moist was used to describe sort of, it was a fresh batch of ale. So, you know, positive thing. But then around the 15th century, 16th century, we start to see it used a lot in medical journals or in medical writings or scientific literature to describe wounds and gangrene and scabies. And by the 1950s and 60s, we also see it describing women's panties. So none of these things are positive associations that get put on it later, especially for women. And it sort of causes that cringe factor the more people have that association with it. And so there was a psychologist that studied word aversion with moist. And he did find about 20% of the population is moist averse. And that people that tended to have more negative reactions to bodily functions and bodily fluids and words about them tended to be more likely to hate the word moist. And it also tended to be in sort of about what that word was associated with for them. So the more it appeared in front of bad words, for example, or negative words, the more often people would say, I hate that word. Moist cake was less aversive than, you know, moist wound or moist basement. So it did seem like there was a decline of acceptability for everybody, depending on what it co-occurred with, but particularly certain people found it more cringy than others, and a good portion of the population. But if you look at the sounds of the word, and this is where the linguist perspective comes in, as opposed to the psychology perspective, there are also some really interesting associations we get with sounds themselves that have been studied in a field called sound symbolism. And it's a really fascinating field. There's actually several pieces of sound symbolism that are in the book, because it really does touch on many things throughout history with the way that languages and accents have developed. So it's an important concept more broadly. But in the terms of moist, the idea here is that certain words have certain sounds have intrinsic meaning associated with them. Now, these are statistical tendencies, not things you could easily point to in a language. But if we look at languages overall, over dozens or thousands, you know, hundreds of languages, we will find that there's sort of this statistical tendency. One thing we find is that in words for body parts, certain sounds reoccur. One thing that reoccurs a lot in certain body parts is nasal sounds. And M is a nasal sound. Now, of course, nose is the primordial example of that. So N and M are both nasal sounds, because if you say N or M, it requires the nose to make it. If you say ta, there's no nose noise coming out, right? But M and N require it. So we find there's a statistical tendency for languages to pick words or create words with N or M sounds when describing noses. English is a perfect example of that, right? We have an N in that. Well, if we look at words for breasts, we also find that there's a statistical tendency across languages for words beginning with what we call bilabial sounds, of which M is one, to be used for words referring to breasts or breast secretions. So think mammary, mammal, right? Bosom, because B is also a bilabial sound, or even melons, which have been used to refer to breasts as well. So we have this tendency to use certain sounds for body parts that may or may not have some social stigma attached. And then on top of that, vowels also seem to tend to make us think of certain either happy things or sad things, depending on the type of vowel. So if you say E, like cheese, like you do for a camera, you actually tend to find people rate their feelings while they're saying it as more happy, right? Or they'll come up with ideas that are more happy. There's actually a really solid amount of research that suggests the E vowel will make people think more happy thoughts. On the opposite end, oi or oo, o, all the back vowels, of which moist is one because the first sound in oi is a back vowel, tends to be more associated with sad things or depressed things. Think mope. Right, is one of those. So that's, again, statistically just a tendency. You're not going to point to a bunch of words in English that necessarily seem to show it, but that does tend to be a tendency. And so that suggests to us that there's some really fundamental principles of meaning that individual sounds might actually inspire in us. And this, of course, would be useful from a child language acquisition standpoint. It would kind of give babies a hint at what words might mean early on. But then that would be overshadowed as they learn language by other cues that they get. The point being that moist is a double whammy, because it has not only an M that is often in words for breasts and breast secretions, it also has a back vowel that brings up notions of sadness and sometimes largeness and depression. So how would you not hate that word, right? In many ways. So it's sort of, and you couple that with all these semantic associations that are negative, like body parts and wounds and things like that. And that's kind of the double whammy of word hatred. And so I think if you combine those two different factors, meaning associations that tend to be make us cringe, plus sounds that sometimes might be heard negatively, and you put them together in the same word, the result is moist, and that's probably why a lot of people don't like it.
After a brief pause, we'll return to our guest today on Art in the Air, Dr. Valerie Friedland.
Art on the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show, whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners? Email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. And we return to today's guest on Art of the Air, Dr. Valerie Friedland on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
Well, I'm going to completely change the direction to babies. And your book was really interesting because I guess it just depends. It's a generational thing. Baby talk, you know, and the views on baby talk. And reading your book really changed the way I think about it. So if you want to talk about, because like sure. For me, you know, you just wonder if the sounds that they hear are what they're going to duplicate. But then what I read in your book really changed my view.
It is one of the greatest myths of parenthood. The other myth is that any of it is easy. As a parent of two children, there's never a point where parenthood is easy. I remember people telling me, oh, you know, when they're babies, it's so easy, they can't run around. And then, you know, you have different stages people tell you. And I'm like, no, actually, having raised two, it's all hard. But the other thing that is the greatest myth is that you should not use baby talk with your children. And we see over and over the cyclic pattern of, you know, parenting magazines and blogs and just general mom information telling people not to baby talk to their children. And it's such an interesting thing because most of the science really points the completely opposite direction. Baby talk helps children. It is really good for the language acquisition process. It's really good for babies to kind of help learn the divides in the speech sounds of the stream of speech they're getting at them. It also seems to help them in maybe understanding some meaning of words and sort of understanding how to structure the stress pattern and melody of their language. There's so much good information that you're giving your babies when you're baby talking them that it's so odd that we have this recurrent cycling of thinking of it as a negative thing. I think the worry that you express is exactly the worry that a lot of people have about it, that you're modeling bad forms of speech. But that's not what a baby at 6 months or a year or two is paying attention to. Because
they're just listening to the vocalness of it or the musicality of it.
They're listening to the speech stream. You have to think about, you know, where sounds are divided in speech because you know the words. But think about babies. They don't know words. All they hear is this massive stream of speech coming at them that has no divisions. And I think the best thing to kind of see how this must feel is go to a country you don't speak the language at all and listen to someone talking. You could not tell them what was a word, what was a sound, what was a sentence, because it's just this barrage of da 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 da. So if you're a baby and this is what you're getting, da 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 da, but then a mother is hyper articulating certain aspects of it, or a father, and sort of elongating the vowel sounds and then hyper-articulating the T versus the D sound. What that's actually doing is helping babies segment that speech stream and also teaching them some of the finer phonetic properties from a statistical learning perspective of what sounds are in their language. So the job of a baby up to, you know, 3, 4 even, is to figure out how to say sounds, figure out what are the sounds, and then figure out how they fit into words and what the influence on each sound as they get put together they can ignore and what they have to pay attention to. And baby talk is helpful with that. I think what parents worry about is they don't see that side of language acquisition. They just see, oh, I need to teach my baby words and, you know, the proper pronunciation. But that's a later thing. And truthfully, they will get that naturally, especially if they have just lots of input. It doesn't necessarily have to be an input of a certain type. So the best thing you can do for your baby is have them have a broad range of input so they're getting all the types of input that they'll hear in the speech around them. And parents, particularly mothers, they are the ones that have been studied to do this the most, naturally seem to adjust their speech in those ways as the baby ages up. So the job of a baby from, you know, 6 months to about 2 is just to figure out the speech. What are the sounds? how do they get strung together? They don't really know words that well yet, and then they're starting to piece together the words, and they use some clues that they've learned from the sounds to figure out the words. But from 2 to 4, they start shifting to learn social nuances with that. And that's where mothers seem to shift from using the more hyper-correct forms, the more elongated articulations, to using more local forms with their babies. So mm-hmm. there's really a noticeable, measurable shift. And that seems to be an unconscious desire to kind of have this more social relationship, to teach children about the power of language as a social device. Of course, you don't know you're doing this, but we do it naturally, which, thank God, because there's so much about parenthood you have to work at. You don't want to have to work at getting their language acquisition on track. But the short story is, don't worry about baby talking to your children. In fact, it's very, very good. If you're not a parent that enjoys it, though, we don't really see it has a harmful effect not to do it. There are cultures where baby talk is different or not as common, and those babies still pick up the sounds. It just may take a little longer. Long-term consequences are probably not extreme. So I think the big message is relax and don't worry about it too much.
Just yeah, enjoy like some of the words are so precious that yeah. I personally didn't even correct them. I'd use the correct word, but I would never say, oh, you have to pronounce it this way, because it was just so delightful to hear
what they came up with. And they couldn't correct it anyway. Other really strong findings we have is that children say the words as they understand them, mm-hmm. not necessarily or as they can produce them, not necessarily as they understand them. So because a baby says a sound a different way than you doesn't mean they don't already understand that the sound they say isn't the sound that you say. It's because articulatorily, certain sounds are really complex and mm-hmm. they come later. So, you know, R's and L's often don't come till a kid is 5 or 6. Or sometimes they continue to have problems with them. So the fact that they substitute a sound is because they are articulatorily trying to learn how to make that sound, not necessarily because they don't know that that's the sound. Right. And if you correct them, it won't matter. They still can't produce it. Children can only, you know, sort of take advantage of correction if they already have access to that form. And so, again, you don't even need to correct your kid. It will come naturally.
You're right. It wasn't our word. It did have an R in it.
Some of the things and speaking of R words, that brought up my next thing, is how people insert letters into things. And something, actually, I experienced with some of my older relatives is the word warsh with the R sound. And the other thing, and this is more a grammatical thing, is substituting to for at. I'm to church as opposed to being at church. And those are some of the, I guess, I don't know if that's just regionalism, but the warsh thing, from reading your book, is something that's elsewhere. And of course, something you addressed in your previous book is about the dropping of endings, like with ing, dropping the G. So talk about that part of how that even comes to accent or identify speech.
Sure. Warsh is something we call intrusive R. You also get it in sometimes in words like Washington or Scorch. Right. And I don't have it natively, so I probably am not doing it exactly as someone who has that feature would. But it does seem to be, it's spread out. You find it in a lot of places. It does seem to have its origin in that mid-Atlantic colony and probably potentially from a Scots-Irish impact. But it's it's really hard to say if that's really its origin, because we don't see it in Scots, for example. But what happens there is it seems to be because the vowel in those words, the vowel in wash, had more lip rounding in colonial times. So it'd be more like squash or wash with a rounder lips. And a lot of times, you know, R's have lip rounding. And a lot of times R's are absorbed into vowels. That's why they have R dropping in Britain, is because the R's kind of got absorbed into the vowels. So sometimes what you see is when an R is absorbed into a vowel, it has something called R coloring that it leaves on the vowel, where the vowel has some traces of lip rounding associated with that R. So what we think might have happened is because of the lip rounding that was more prevalent in those words, people kind of misconstrued an R in them from having heard lots of R's that were sort of starting to die out in certain words, and that became warsh or squarsh, which is an intrusive R. That's a little different than something called the linking R that is not done by the same speakers, where you might see someone say lore in order, or I have an idea about that. And that's something called a linking R, and that's actually related to people typically that drop their R's in other circumstances, and it's a pretty complex pattern, so I won't bore you with it here. But it's really fascinating when, you know, people notice these things, but there's a really cool history and actually very principled linguistic process that explains why we do it.
The ing ending, you also addressed in Like Literally Dude about dropping the G and how that process happens.
Yeah, so that one is a little different. That one is actually historically more accurate to drop the G than it is to not drop the G, which I think surprises people because that's one, as many features that have happened over time that we thought of as correct that actually was at one point considered incorrect or less proper, but somehow it gets, you know, tied with something, in this case with writing, and then all of a sudden, oh yeah, that's the better form. So it's really arbitrary, you know, in the same way that dropping an R in Britain is considered good English and dropping your R's here is usually like working class variety. So it's, you know, it's a fascinating kind of revolution of good and bad over time. But the G is from an old ending in Old English that was inge, and the in version is from an ending in Old English that was inde, and inde was actually how you would form a verbal participle, essentially, in Old English. Now, Old English didn't really have progressive participles. You would just say you were doing something that day, so it would be in present form, and then you would indicate that it was a continuous action in another way, like say, you know, every day I go, and typically you wouldn't use it as a main verb, it would have been an adverbial clause. So needless to say, it was very different in Old English, but it was mainly Latin translations where we see inde being used in a progressive sort of sense. And inge was actually a different ending altogether on nouns. And over time, because of dropping of endings in Old English. Between the Old English and Middle English period, we had sound changes and stress pattern changes that caused us to lose a lot of endings, which is why we, for example, don't have grammatical gender in English anymore, and we don't have case very much in English anymore, because all of those were done through endings. And when you stop pronouncing endings, they kind of go away the way of the dodo. Mm-hmm. And so you had inge and inde. Well, those, once you drop the ending, are just in and in.
Right.
Right. And maybe a little colored by the G. So ing is actually not ing. That's not three. You don't say inga. It's ing, which is what we call a velar nasal. And so that's probably the distinction that existed between those. It was probably in for inde and ing for inge. But those were very close. And in fast speech, probably imperceptibly close, especially depending on what kind of vowel went before them. And so gradually people started to conflate them. And so we see for hundreds of years a writing that was written with a G because they thought that was the ending that went on it, but few people wrote at that time. And in pronunciation, up through, you know, 18th century, we see people saying that the in pronunciation is the correct one for people at court. You know, we see elocution manuals that say that. We also see people like Jonathan Swift that uses it for rhyme schemes. So, for example, rhyming brewing with ruin, which can't happen if it's brewing, only if it's Bruin. And so we have good evidence that was actually in. And then the 19th century, when literacy became more widespread and people were like, oh, dang, there's a G on that. That's when people started thinking, oh, it's ing, that's the correct version. So again, it's just such a fascinating backstory to something that we're so sure we know the right, you know, version of today.
So Valerie, do you have an opinion on language programs and which might give you the best chance to achieve the most authentic pronunciation possible?
You mean for people that are learning a second language?
Correct, yes.
You know, I think a lot of times there are a number of different factors that go into that, and it depends on the language background you have. But what you can never go wrong with in language learning is having genuine interaction with speakers of that language. That seems to be some of the best input to get the more natural pronunciation. I think the bottom line, and something I talk a lot about in the book, is that an accent is a good thing, not a bad thing. It tells people who you are. It's part of your identity, and it's a beautiful aspect of our human nature because we all have accents. So I think what we need to get away from is this idea that we need to lose an accent when we're learning another language, but really invest in being intelligible in that language, which doesn't necessarily mean the same thing, right? So you can have a heavy accent and still be heard as really intelligible. So The trick is then to work on the words and sounds that particularly create problems for intelligibility for you, rather than to focus on sounds that make you sound more native-like. So my advice is in the book and in general that you should really focus on working on things that you know you have problems with in terms of people understanding you. And for a lot of people, for example, the TH sound is a hard one in English. It's very rare across languages. It's a weird sound, and only about 8% of languages even have it. So chances are if you're learning English, you don't have that sound. But if you don't have that sound, it's not a big deal because there are very few words in English where saying a TH sound as a T or a D will confuse anybody because there's not a lot of overlapping words with that. So that people spend a lot of time working on that sound, and it's really, other than not sounding like you're from somewhere else, there's very little point to that if it's not intelligibility helping, right? So instead, vowels often are really hard for speakers. R's and L's are really hard for speakers, and I would focus my efforts on those. And if you don't actually have access to native speakers, there are ways now with the rise of the internet to really get good feedback. And one thing I think people don't want to hear, but it's sort of the truth with everything from calculus to language learning, is practice is key. Yeah. And the more you practice, the more you imitate, the more you shadow, the more you talk, the better you will be. So there's really nothing to get away from the classic advice of practice, practice, practice.
No, always.
You're listening to our guest today, Dr. Valerie Freeman on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM and on WVLP, 103.1 FM. One thing you brought up in your previous book and you talked about in this one too is vocal fry. Maybe explain that, what vocal fry is.
Sure. Well, vocal fry is when we sort of go to a low pitch and we have a little extra vibration and it comes out sounding kind of crackly. It's also called creaky voice. And, you know, a lot of people associate with young women when they are talking on social media a lot or shows like The Kardashian. And it's really where they go to the end and they're like, I don't know about that. I don't really like it. And that's over hyper articulated. I don't have a lot of vocal fry except when I'm really tired, and it's because your vocal folds are moving more slowly. And so they kind of create this crackle that is heard often when we come to the end of a breath point or at the end of a sentence. Is that's why it's sort of salient. The trick is that both men and women do it, but women have to drop to a lower pitch to do it, so it's more salient in their voices. But it also seems to have started to take on sort of some social identity marking for young women. And a lot of times young women in urban areas use it for a more sort of chill, professional persona. It's not always heard that way, though, so a lot of people that hear it don't like it. Even though actually in Britain, where it was first studied and studied for many, many years, so the first studies we see on that is 1960s, 1970s, it's actually more prevalent among men there and taken as an aristocratic feature that kind of was a bored affectation, but also higher class. So it's sort of funny. This is another one that has flipped. But because it's associated with young women, and we tend to associate young women with things that are less positive, like being vacuous and uncertain, unfortunately, that stereotype has been put on vocal fry, and a lot of women take a lot of flack for it. Oh, and I just did some vocal fry right there.
Right there. That was great. A great example. She's actually gives a good example. So the future of accents. I mean, in your book, you've talked about how, I remember there was one where they couldn't understand the word zero because the TA had an accent. Is it a matter that we need to be more accepting of accents and broaden our thing? Or how does that work? Like, that's more of a sociology question. Mm-hmm. Well, you're a social linguist anyway, so let's try that.
Right. I do a little bit of both. Okay. Really a two-part question you asked there. So let's tackle sort of one and the other. First, the future of accents. Well, that's a huge question. We could do a whole show. The long and short of it is regional accents among young speakers in urban areas are declining. People have commented on that and wondered if it was true. And research does back that up. There are lots of reasons for that. It's really not a Gen Z thing. It's not the social internet or the social media and internet as much as long-term structural changes in society that now social media have really accelerated. And so, yes, the internet has changed the way we talk, but the accent piece of it really started years before that. So Gen X is the first generation for which that is true. That doesn't mean accents are dying. It just means regional accents in urban areas are decreasing, and other types of divides that we have, for example, ethnicity or politics or class, are becoming more salient markers in our accent. So that's the future of accents puzzle piece.
So time to get your Smithsonian recording in so we don't lose
exactly,
the accents.
Exactly. It's a sad thing. I mean, there are a lot of people that lament the loss of accents because there is a history and heritage there. And I absolutely empathize with that. But it's a cycle. I don't think it means accents regionally are dying. We go through cycles over time. The American accent has done it. There was a time when people talked about a uniform American accent in the pre-revolutionary days. And then people complained about how many different accents there were and wanting to get rid of those. So, you know, we're never happy with that. So, and then part two of your question that I have forgotten by now. So let's go. What was part two of your question?
I don't remember now. It's, and we're getting to our final couple minutes here. I want to give you a chance to talk about a few things. Well, one thing, and this is a whole new conversation, is about the future of English. It's become the lingua franca of our thing, or Latin was, and the French was. Do you think that's going to continue on for because of the way it's kind of embedded into like all the media?
I think absolutely it will remain a big, powerful world language. I think the difference will be others will become also powerful. I think, you know, Chinese might seem daunting to those people who don't speak it, but it's certainly really their appearance in the world power kind of area and also in trade has grown substantially. And whenever you get a country or a nation becoming very, very powerful, it's there's an opportunity there for people that can speak that language. So I wouldn't be surprised if some of the other big power languages become bigger and become also more frequently used. And as we change the global dynamics, which languages those will be over English will depend on which languages really become the language of trade to, you know, a great extent. But that doesn't mean that English will lessen its hold, because I think it's so widespread now. There are so many places where English is even an official language in a place where no one speaks it natively, that it's not going to die out in that capacity for, you know, any foreseeable future.
In our final minute here, tell us about where you can find your book. We're recording this on the day that it's released, April 23rd, and of course we'll air this a little bit later, but tell us how they can find about you, the website, and your book.
Sure. Well, if they just want more information on me and some of my work and the things I write about and the research I do, they can just go to my website, which is valeriefriedland.com. And find out all sorts of things about me there. If they're interested in the book, well, anywhere books are sold, you should be able to find it. You know, all the usual suspects. And I would love it if people enjoyed the book and found it helpful at understanding how we can be better communicators. Because I think what you had asked before is about accents and communication. And the reality is that communication is a partnership, right? And it's never about one person. It's always about both of us. So, you know, if we let accents stand in the way of communication, then that's not good for anybody. So my hope is that this book will help us see the unity behind the accents, even if the surface level features are different.
Well, we appreciate coming back on Art in the Air with Why We Talk Funny, the real story behind our accent, Valerie Friedland. And you can find it anywhere at bookstores and everything. It's a great read. I told Valerie earlier that when I was reading it, it's a very fast read, except when you have to stop and do all the little exercises that are in there to try to mouth things. Valerie, thank you so much for coming back on Art in the Air.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. It's always so wonderful to read your books.
I appreciate that. I really appreciate you making the effort. And I love the questions that you asked. You know, some of the smaller things like moist get overlooked in a lot of the other interviews. So I love those stories. So thank you very much. And thank you for reaching out. It was a pleasure to come back.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Emberforge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know. Esther and Larry are on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.